This week, how do you engage your lodge in a thoughtful discussion aimed at revealing the shortcomings of Masonic education, all while being brotherly? This week, Mark St. Cyr takes us through exactly that, how to assist your lodge in realizing its shortcoming in Masonic education and what you can do about it. Then, illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison takes us through the Morgan affair in a condensed form, but it's not really about Morgan. It's an interesting story of an order given by DeWitt Clinton, perhaps one of the most altruistic orders anyone in Masonry ever made, considering the circumstances. Then, we take a look at a famous poem by Edgar Allan Poe. Darren A. Laners takes it apart and asks the question, is the Cask of Amontillado a quasi-Masonic degree in hiding? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. It's through your help and assistance that we're able to reach so many people all over the world interested in the royal art. Since July of 2011, we've been producing this podcast on a weekly basis, and it's no small endeavor. If you're interested in how to help out the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out your various options to assist us. All right, now right off the bat, we've got a large episode here, and I want to go ahead and get into this next awesome segment from Mark St. Cyr in the Education Application Series.
For the Whence Came You podcast, I'm Mark St. Cyr with this week's installment of its Education Application Series. First, as always, the disclaimer. The following viewpoint does not represent any Grand Lodge or concordant body and is solely that of the presenter. Please be sure to check with your jurisdiction's rules for governance relating to anything discussed here before considering any application thereof. So with that said, let's dig in. After pretty much covering the idea of culture both from a micro and macro perspective, it's now time to delve directly into the application aspect which prompted them. Now, as I say ad nauseum, there will be many that will want to push back, want to say this or that, or shout down these concepts. But here's the twist. That's not only okay, it's actually encouraged. Why? Because without the doubters, the naysayers, the unconvinced, you nor I would ever partake in the true test of education, which is application. For words without deeds are dead. Let's pull that thread together, shall we? When you have garnered the ability, along with the courage, to both explain defects or defend benefits on a given subject in real time, without equivocation against all comers, that is when you will demonstrate the why others should listen to you. Until then, words are just that, only words. To grow in both the understanding of topics as well as their applications, you have to be willing to engage. Only then will you know if you're on the correct path for true rhetorical discourse. Or said differently, you can't be scared of the naysayers. Fervent rhetorical discourse is just one of the many aspects of applied education we are supposed to be pursuing within our walls. It is a required skill and discipline for the toolbox of any so-called learned man, and it requires endless honing for effectiveness. This is an aspect of education that gets missed by so many. For education, true education happens in full-throated discourse, and it is precisely this that our lodges are designed for. In other words, the idea that peace and harmony within a lodge means a subservient posture to title, age, and years served is as preposterous of an idea as allowing the current management of a once thriving enterprise to continue unquestioned as the company's value and reputation crumbles. Sound familiar? Maybe I digressed. Then again, maybe not. Let's pull this thread even further, shall we? The very idea that the confines of a lodge room can have vociferous, sanctioned, full-throated arguments about such things like what bills to pay, do we replace the boiler, why aren't there enough volunteers for this much fish fry, and much more. Yet everything short of this is off-limits? Sorry, but that's a complete and utter disservice to the very idea that founded this great fraternity. The contemplation and the pursuit of ideals, politics, religion, the cosmos, and more were precisely the types of subject matter that were primarily discussed within our hallowed walls. All presented on the merits and arguments of learned men within the framework of civilized and proper rhetorical discourse, free from the ridicule of the uninformed zealot or profane. That's what once took place regularly. But we've traveled so far off the sublime path, lost the plot so long ago, those doing most of the arguing to continue this folly can't even explain what something as simple as our stations truly do anymore when pushed. Think I'm off base? Now let's put this whole education application thingy to the test right here and right now, shall we? Here's a test for efficacy. For those that question or are hesitant to the idea of Masonic education, put them on the spot and in full view using something like this as a prompt. Let's say concerning the stations. Ask, please explain to me three distinct features and the application thereof in either the larger community, business, or even personal sense that a brother will gain spending one term in, say, oh, I don't know, let's use the junior stewardship. Then wait. Say nothing till they finish. If they can. If they do, and it's low-hanging fruit stuff, you can challenge that, and you should. Here's an example of something like that. They get to learn the workings of a lodge. Where you might respond, okay, but that's kind of low-hanging fruit like the making good men better bromide. We say it, but we really can't explain the true process for application. Can you elaborate further precisely what aspect and how it translates? I'll bet dollars to donuts you'll have a hard time getting past one, never mind all the way to three. The point here is not to embarrass. The point is to make your argument meaningful. And it is here you should be both delicate as well as respectful and present a how and why that station alone begins the process of making good men better. All men. Because then, I mean, of course, with asking for permission, of course, depending on your situation, you should then take the floor expressing not just three, but 30. Yes, 30. And here's how. Let's use a man of minimum age requirement to petition and receive our degrees for our first example. You should be able to list 15 skills that will be learned and applicable for advancement either up the line, social interactions, business understandings, as well as their own personal skills. Then you should have the same number, again 15, but totally different objective reasonings for what a man, say 50 years old or older, that is fully formed, like somebody already successful in business or within your community. Maybe they're wealthy. Scratch that. Make them incredibly wealthy. What is it that they are going to gain from that same station? You don't need to recite all 30 then and there, but you do need to know and be able to recall that at will. This interaction may only require you to explain one for only a few minutes to get your point across. You may state 10 and only spend seconds on each. You get the idea. But the idea is that you can and will. That is application in action, and it builds momentum. For what you've also begun is a real education process, one that can be presented at every meeting if warranted going forward, simply using every station that both educates new members as well as the older, and it can't be argued away in a, well, we don't do that esoteric stuff here, because we're not talking about that anymore, are we? Correct? This is how you begin the true process of making good men better, and you can explain how. But make no mistake, as I always warn, this is not a situation to enter in half-cocked. You must have, at the least, those 30 and the ability to recall and argue beforehand. If not, you'll look totally foolish and you'll simply be dismissed as such. But here's a hidden bonus to all this if your arguments are unsuccessful. At the very least, you yourself will have a better, more fundamental idea of what Freemasonry portends than many of those within that pretend to know. And that's a great starting point for all of us. So for the Whence Came You podcast, I'm Mark St. Cyr. Thanks for listening.
All right, some hard truths there. But what I really liked about this piece is that I think a lot of people take some of this business pushiness kind of thing, and they say, well, it's really unbrotherly. But if you listened to Brother Mark St. Cyr in this piece, he tells it like it is. You're not doing this to embarrass anybody. You're doing this delicately and in a way that hopefully gets brothers to really think. And of course, as he said, you've done a little bit of introspective thinking and writing on this as you prepared for this brotherly confrontation. The beauty of this is, of course, that by even bringing this up, you've essentially brought in Masonic education. All right. Now, before we get into the article, let's get into another great segment from the always industrious Stephen L. Harrison, an all-new Masonic Minute. Let's check it out.
The Morgan Affair has continued to plague Freemasonry for two centuries. In 1826, a man named William Morgan showed up in Batavia, New York, and became part of the Masonic community. He was probably not a Freemason, but worked his way into the craft when a friend vouched for him. He was subsequently initiated into a chapter of Royal Arch Masonry in Leroy, New York. When the brothers in Batavia applied for a Royal Arch chapter charter in their community, Morgan's name was on the list of petitioners. This would have automatically made him a member of the new chapter. By this time, Morgan had developed a reputation as being a heavy drinker, a man who could not handle his finances, and local Masons were beginning to doubt he had ever been initiated as a member of the fraternity. Morgan had also become involved in a dispute with another brother who was well known and powerful. The locals disapproved of Morgan's handling of that conflict. Questioning Morgan's character, the Batavia brothers drew up a new petition for a charter, leaving Morgan's name off. When the charter was granted, the Batavia Royal Arch chapter denied him membership or visitation rights. With the troubles he had been having with the Batavia brothers, Morgan had been contemplating turning against them and writing a book which would reveal the secrets of the order. He may have even started writing it by that time, but if not, the incident with the local Royal Arch chapter was the last straw. Morgan fervently went to work on the exposé. Word got around town, probably due to Morgan's alcohol-fueled bragging, about what he was doing. This irritated the Masons. So, what do you do when you're irritated? Well, what else? You raid Morgan's home, illegally confiscate his documents, set his partner's business on fire, kidnap, imprison, and maybe even kill the guy. Then cry in your beer when the book gets published anyway. Now, some thought that might be an overreaction, but that's what they did. And the furor over what happened to Morgan has been like the sword of Damocles hanging over the Masons for two centuries. But many people, perhaps too many, already know that story. So that's not really what I wanted to talk about. What I want to talk about is DeWitt Clinton. At the time all this happened, DeWitt Clinton was governor of New York. He was also General Grand High Priest of the General Grand Chapter of Royal Arch Masons. He was a powerful guy and was very well aware of the shenanigans going on in Batavia. A Mason by the name of Robert Martin set out to deliver Morgan's papers to the General Grand Chapter. When he arrived, Clinton was not there. Martin met with a committee acting under Clinton's direction. It was chaired by Samuel Knapp of Massachusetts. Martin handed over all of Morgan's documents, but Knapp shoved them right back at him. Under Clinton's authority, he told Martin, "You will return those papers to their rightful owner." When Martin told Knapp that person was in prison for debt, Knapp instructed him to raise the money from the fraternity, pay Morgan's debts in order to free him, and return the papers to him. Those orders were ignored. Morgan disappeared, and the Masonic fraternity has suffered for it ever since. Imagine, if you will, that Clinton and Knapp's orders had been obeyed. Morgan would have published his book, which was eventually published anyway. The book, for a while, would have caused a stir and then faded into history like all of the other Masonic exposés of the time. The anti-Masonic movement would have been denied the turbocharged boost of the Morgan affair, and today, William Morgan might not even be a footnote in Masonic history. DeWitt Clinton's orders were a very Masonic response which, if followed, would have mitigated the whole volatile situation. Freemasons are admonished to learn to subdue their passions and improve themselves in Freemasonry. Clinton had learned that. Knapp had learned that. Others had not. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, a quick overview of the Morgan affair, which, of course, I think many people know about, probably most. I did have a chuckle at Brother Harrison's rundown of the events that happened after the threatening of the publication of a ritual. What is, and I think what everybody should actually focus on here, though, with all that set aside, is the response from DeWitt Clinton as someone who could have done any number of things as a grand master of the Royal Arch or even in his political status. He chose to do something that was non-retaliatory and certainly is in this or under this canopy of almost altruism. And with all that said, I guess, as Steve pointed out, this is perhaps the most Masonic response that could have happened, regardless of the character of one William Morgan. Make sure you subscribe to the YouTube channel so that you can see the video that accompanies this particular Masonic Minute. That'll go up also on our YouTube channel, and you can see the cool slideshow that Brother Steve has put up for us. As promised in the opener, we've got a Gothic-type article in that this is about Edgar Allan Poe's perverse Masonic degree, the Cask of Amontillado. This piece originated on the Midnight Freemasons blog, and it was written by worshipful brother Darren A. Laners. So let's check it out. Edgar Allan Poe's perverse Masonic degree, the Cask of Amontillado. In Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Cask of Amontillado, published in 1846, revenge is the motive for a gruesome murder that takes place in an underground vault. There is no evidence that Poe was a Freemason. Many authors have gone out of their way to argue that the short story is an anti-Masonic work and that Poe had publicly mocked the Freemasons, especially in his essay, The Unparalleled Adventure of One Hans Fall, prior to his writing of The Cask of Amontillado. Compiling to this is an idea that Edgar's strained relationship with his wealthy foster father, John Allen, was a Freemason, and this led to Poe to cast him in the role of Fortunato, I find it difficult to fathom that Poe would have held onto a grudge 13 years after his foster father's death. In a column by E.J. Edwards in the Washington, D.C. Herald, published on December 2, 1913, entitled Captain Wagner's Recollections of Edgar Allan Poe, there is an odd recollection given by Captain Frederick C. Wagner. Captain Wagner had an association with Sarah Helen Whitman, Poe's one-time fiancée, whom Poe had met in 1845. So this would have been the earliest time when he may have met him. Wagner was also apparently a Freemason, although I could not confirm this. Quote, I presume that very few persons are now living who ever saw, certainly very few who ever talked with Edgar Allan Poe, said Captain Frederick C. Wagner to me. In his day, he was a very prominent citizen of New York and was well known to the Masonic fraternity of the United States by his prominent identification with the establishment of the Great Masonic Home at Utica, New York. I am fortunate enough to be able to recall many meetings of Poe and several interesting conversations which I had with him at one time or another. End quote. If Poe was anti-Masonic, why would he support the building of the Masonic Home in Utica, New York? Perhaps Captain Wagner was confused as he states, quote, My recollections of Edgar are among the most pleasant of any of those of my young manhood in New York City. I find it difficult to believe that Poe would have been able to give financially to the Masonic Home Building Fund. However, I do think that Poe did not have issues with individual Freemasons, but with the institution itself. In any case, there is enough evidence presented in the Cask of Amontillado to state that Poe was familiar with Freemasonry. Many authors also state that Poe and others of that time would have had an idea of Freemasonry and its workings due to the Morgan Affair in 1826. However, I believe that Poe had knowledge of some of the higher degrees of Freemasonry either through the various exposés that came forward at his time or through associations with Freemasons like Wagner. In any case, an argument can and has been made for what occurs to the characters in the Cask of Amontillado as being a reenactment of a Masonic degree. However, I want to postulate something different. It is my argument that if you view the Masonic elements in reverse, they reenact the second section of the Fellowcraft degree. First, let's discuss the story and the Masonic elements contained therein. The story begins with the protagonist, Montresor, confessing his dark deed to some unknown person. He regales the story of how he has suffered 1,000 insults at the hand of his nemesis, Fortunato. He says that Fortunato has one weakness, which is that he is a connoisseur of wine. Montresor encounters his nemesis at Carnival and informs him that he has a pipe, a measurement of cask sizes, of Amontillado in his possession, but he doubts it. Montresor quite cleverly states that he can engage another expert, Lucchese, to look at the cask, and as he does not want to occupy Fortunato's time, using Fortunato's ego against him because Fortunato doubts Lucchese's ability to correctly identify the wine, Montresor is able to convince Fortunato to look at this cask. Montresor continues to try to persuade Fortunato to not come with him, telling him about the dampness of his vaults and worrying about Fortunato's coughing, but nothing dissuades him from his mission. They continue into the vaults after grabbing two torches and descending a long, winding staircase. Once in the vaults of Montresor Palazzo, Montresor plies Fortunato with alcohol, first a bottle of Medoc, followed by a flask of De Grave. At this point, Poe gives the following description. Quote, I broke and reached him a flagon of De Grave. He emptied it at a breath. His eyes flashed with a fierce light. He laughed and threw the bottle upwards with a gesticulation I did not understand. I looked at him in surprise. He repeated the movement, a grotesque one. You do not comprehend? He said. Not I, I replied. Then you are not of the Brotherhood. How? You are not of the Masons. Yes, yes, said I. Yes, yes. You, impossible, a Mason? A Mason, I replied. A sign, he said. A sign. It is this, I answered, producing a trowel from beneath the folds of my roquelaire. You jest, he exclaimed, recoiling a few paces. But let us proceed to the Amontillado. Be it so, I said, replacing the tool beneath the cloak and again offering him my arm. He leaned upon it heavily. We continued our route, in search of the Amontillado. We passed through a range of low arches, descended and passed on, and descending again, arrived at a deep crypt, in which the foulness of the air caused our flambeau rather to glow than flame. End quote. At this point, they arrive at the Montresor family crypt, wherein there is discovered a recess that is 4 feet in depth, 3 feet in width, and 6 to 7 feet in height in between two colossal supports for the roof of the catacombs. Montresor exclaims that the cask is therein, and when Fortunato investigates, the trap is sprung. Montresor chains Fortunato to the wall by wrapping the chain around his waist and padlocking it. Montresor then begins to lay bricks and walls up the recess, entombing Fortunato alive. Many authors have tried to describe the journey that Fortunato and Montresor take as being a Masonic degree. They point to the description of the winding staircase, the dialogue above, and the description of two colossal supports as evidence of this. The problem with this is that it makes no sense chronologically to what happens in the Fellowcraft degree, which is the only degree that features the winding staircase. However, when you reverse the chronological timing, a more complete picture comes into shape. The candidate, at the end of the first section of the Fellowcraft degree, is told the following, quote, "In accordance with an ancient custom adopted in every regular and well-governed lodge, it will be necessary that you make a regular advance through a porch by a flight of winding stairs consisting of 3, 5, and 7 steps to a place representing the middle chamber of King Solomon's temple, where you will find the worshipful master who will give you the instruction relative to the wages and jewels of a fellow craft. What happens in the second section? Allow me to explain with the aid of what Fortunato and Montresor do. The candidate emerges from the anteroom. Fortunato, in the recess, proceeds through the two brazen pillars. Fortunato is led by Montresor into the crypt, to a winding staircase. Fortunato and Montresor descend the staircase into the vaults under Montresor's palazzo, to a place representing the middle chamber of King Solomon's temple. Montresor and Fortunato, while they are above ground, where you will find the worshipful master who will give you instruction relative to the wages and jewels of a fellow craft. Montresor's initial meeting with Fortunato, wages, coin, and jewels, in a classical sense, would make up the treasure, and Montresor's name means my treasure. There are many jurisdictions that have within their lodge rooms a physical representation of the pillars along with the flight of winding stairs, which takes them to a room overlooking the lodge room that represents the middle chamber of King Solomon's temple. Did Poe mean to do this? We'll never know. There's more than enough evidence to suggest that Poe had knowledge of this degree and incorporated it into his work. So where does that leave us? With a mystery, the way Poe intended it. I will say that Poe was, toward the end of his life, when the story was published, thinking about the nature of God and our universe. His lengthy Eureka, a prose poem, published in 1848, gives us a deep insight into his beliefs, and I would say echoes some themes discussed in Masonic philosophy. Even the title of his work should be familiar to every Freemason, even if it is attributed incorrectly to Pythagoras instead of Archimedes. However, there is no evidence that Poe was a Mason. However, I do not believe that he was anti-Masonic. I think that he was critical of the institution of Freemasonry, but also perhaps intrigued by its mysteries. Darren A. Laners, Managing Editor, Midnight Freemasons. Wonderful piece. Love Edgar Allan Poe. I love the explanation of the cask of Amontillado in the sense of reversing it. I had never in a million years would have thought of this. And quite interesting. Any Edgar Allan Poe fans out there might have seen any number of movies that involve Edgar. In fact, there was a movie not too long ago, maybe 10 years, a movie starring John Cusack as Edgar Allan Poe, which was quite good in my opinion. And I'm actually looking forward to watching this latest one with Christian Bale, where he plays a detective enlisting the help of one Edgar Allan Poe. I think it's called The Blue Dot or The Blue Eye or something like that. And then, of course, the latest on Netflix that has everybody going crazy is The Fall of the House of Usher, which people are claiming is a amazing and imaginative rendition of Poe's works. So certainly, while Poe isn't a Mason or his writings aren't really Masonic, the theme of symbolism is definitely something that is in his work, and symbolism in general in things of this nature tend to engage the minds of philosophers and thinkers alike. So I think this was a really good adventure. Thanks, Darren, for your work here. Really looking forward to continuing to read your great articles. If you want, you can also catch Darren A. Lehners on his podcast, Meet, Act, and Part. He's a co-host of. And then also, you can catch him and I talking pretty candidly about all kinds of things in high strangeness on our podcast or / videocast, Beyond the Fourth Veil, which is on YouTube. I'll have links to all that in the show notes. And I really need to get back on the ball. We've got some recorded episodes of Beyond the Fourth Veil that I need to get up on the site. So look for those in the future. That's it for this week. I do want to thank you all for coming with me on this edifying journey. I want to thank Mark St. Cyr. I want to thank Stephen L. Harrison and, of course, Darren Lehners for all their hard work in producing Masonic Education, because it's something worth saving. Believe it or not, in the years leading up to now, let's call it around 2010 or so, we had a massive movement, grassroots, you could call it, to employ Masonic education in terms of philosophy, history, and practical teachings. And of course, while Grand Lodges tended not to acknowledge the efforts of Masonic educators and instead would rather create programs or delegate all existing programs to Masonic educators in an attempt to somehow utilize their skills to push different kinds of what they might consider education, largely administrative items. We were able to hold this off for a long while, but my brothers, make no mistake that Masonic education will need saving, not unlike the clock tower in Back of the Future. It's not time to rest on our laurels. It's time to continue pushing, continue educating, and to continue to be able to push Masonic education so that those Masonic educators get a seat at the grown-up table. I want to thank our supporters, those of you who are contributors, fellows, producers, and of course our legacy partners for making the show possible. If you've been listening for a very long time and you've ever even had the inkling, hey, I wonder how I could help. Well, you can, of course, go to WCYpodcast.com and check out the various options, but if you scroll all the way down to the bottom of that, you can even make a one-time gift. Send us a dollar. Whatever you send goes right back into the production of this show and is greatly appreciated. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
Yeah.